Okay, I will call this property tax committee to order. We'll note that we do have quorum, and first is to approve the minutes of the last meeting. Representative Nelson, would you like to move that?
I took a look at the minutes, and I move approval of the minutes as written.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. So first on the agenda today, we have Catherine Schill from House Fiscal that will give us an overview. I'm going to do my best to stay within the time frame because they're kind of boxing me in to make sure that I execute on time. So we have 10 minutes, so if we could let Catherine do her presentation and then answer any questions after, that would be greatly appreciated. Ms. Schill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Catherine Schill, House Fiscal Analysis. Today we will do a brief overview of the tools that you can use for fiscal analysis. In your packet, you have a paper-clipped set of documents. One contains a base level spreadsheet, and then you have two samples of a revenue estimate and a fiscal note, and that's what I will be referring to. Just one more thing. I think also in your packet you'll see this document. It's entitled Catalog of Budget Activities for Tax Aids and Credits. That will be a reference point for any item on the base level spreadsheet. But let me begin first of all with an overview of the tracking sheet. The purpose of the legislative tracking sheet is to show current law tax revenues and program spending and any proposed changes offered in a bill or a group of bills. Legislative fiscal analysts, Ms. Templin and I, for this particular committee and the tax committee, track bill proposals throughout the session and compare costs of those proposals to current law. So what is current law? Current law is a combination of existing tax revenues and program expenditures plus projected growth in the U.S. and state economy. Minnesota Management and Budget, MMB, is responsible for producing Minnesota's budget and economic forecasts twice per year in November and again in February. So we will have a budget forecast update come to us next month. Fiscal analysts follow these forecasts and provide tracking updates that are posted on the House Fiscal webpage. The sample spreadsheet in your packet today shows general fund program spending for tax refunds, aids, and credits. This is the current law base budget spreadsheet overseen by the Property Tax Division, and I'll tell you, it's the simplest version of the division spreadsheet that you will see from us this session. Please note that the format is presented for budgeting purposes where positive numbers are program expenditures or revenue losses. Negative numbers are cost savings or revenue gains. And you can see that. Here's the base spreadsheet. That particular item is this teeny, teeny print that you see in the header right above where you have column headings. Now, those column headings present three biennia of spending information. Column A is the current biennium fiscal 22 and 23. Column D is projected spending for fiscal 24 and 25, which is the upcoming biennial period. Column G is spending for fiscals 26 and 27, known as the planning years. These program expenditures are all from the general fund and segmented into four sections. Tax refunds can be found on lines 2 through 10. This is where you'll see homestead credit, state refund, renter's credit, and the like. Remember, tax refunds are direct payments from the state to taxpayer to lessen their tax burden. Tax refunds represent about 40% of total spending in property tax refunds, aids, and credits. Moving on down the page, lines 12 through 39 represent local aids. This is where you'll find local government aid, county program aid, items that will be discussed today, and other aids. in the budget area. Remember, local aids are state payments to local jurisdictions intended to replace property tax levy revenue. Local aids represent about 40% also of the overall spending. Moving down the page further, lines 42 through 58 are property tax credits. Tax credits reduce property tax liabilities for individual taxpayers. Local taxing jurisdictions receive state payment for these credits. And then moving on the spreadsheet to page 2, flip it over, you'll find three other sections. One entitled Taconite Tax Relief Area Aids and Credits, lines 60 through 66. Local pension aids, lines 68 through 77. And then other aids and one-time appropriations are reflected on lines 82 through 97. These appropriations usually have a tax-related purpose, usually to a state agency or local government, and usually administrative in nature. Total spending, you'll see on line 98. And if you follow column D, you'll see that forecasted spending for the fiscal 24-25 biennium totals just under $4.5 billion. Once again, if you have any questions on specific items contained in this tracking sheet, turn to the catalog of tax aids and credits. There is a thumbnail description for each item. For example, on page 12, you'll see one for local government aid. The thumbnail description provides 8 years of spending, the appropriation type, the fund from which the monies come, and a short description that contains some pretty valuable information. And that ends the discussion on the spreadsheet. We can move to the other tools used in this committee for evaluating the impact of legislation brought forth. We'll turn to the sample revenue estimate. It is House File 1095, Representative Hertas. And this is just meant to be an example of a revenue estimate. You'll see plenty of these in committee. Estimates, revenue estimates are prepared by the Department of Revenue, not the Legislative Budget Office. And they provide an analysis of how bill language would change state tax collections or state expenditures for property tax relief programs. Note that this does not estimate how the bill language would affect state agency or local government administrative costs. For that, we would use a fiscal note. And the basics of a revenue estimate include the explanation of estimating methodology that is used, and any comments on the interpretation of statutory language. So if you take a look at the revenue estimate, you can see it's broken into four different parts. The very top is important, the date and bill version for which the estimate is prepared. This is important because we get updates not only for the forecast, but for other factors that might change the impact of the revenue estimate. For example, even an author's amendment can change the impact. Under that, you'll see the fund and the budget activity that is impacted by the bill, and 4 years worth of forecast anticipated impact by fiscal year. This is important because sometimes we have, or many times we have, the basis of property taxes is in a calendar year format, but for budgeting purposes, it needs to be presented in fiscal year format, and so it goes through conversion. We can talk about that as each bill comes along. The next section is an explanation of the bill. And then there's a revenue analysis section providing more detail on how the revenue estimate was calculated. And if you flip over to the back part, page 2, unique to this division is a measurement of property tax benchmarks. Property tax benchmarks and critical indicators were brought to us in each of these analyses presented to the division about 10 years ago. And this is actually in state statute 270C.991, where the purpose of the property tax benchmarks are to better evaluate the various property tax proposals that come before the legislature, following basic property tax principles that should be taken into consideration. And you can see the different benchmarks that are listed: transparency and understandability, simple and efficient, equitable, stable and predictable, compliance and accountability, competitiveness both nationally and globally, and responsive to economic indicators. And that's basically to let you know how the bill impacts the property tax system in particular. Moving on to the use of fiscal notes, you also have a fiscal note example in your packet. It looks like this. And how often do we use fiscal notes in this committee? Maybe 10% of the time. Most of the time we will be using revenue estimates, but on occasion we'll need a fiscal note. And you should know there are certain proposals that might require both a fiscal note and a revenue estimate. We can get into the details of why. But the revenue estimate, you might be more familiar because these are, fiscal note. The fiscal note is used in most other fiscal committees. And so it also is divided into section. You have a header section that will give not only the bill number and version, it will provide who's the author, the date, and this one in particular has more than one agency impacted. And that's important because it might give us a clue on not only concerns that might be in this division, but in other state agencies for other fiscal committees. To the right, you'll see state fiscal impact, the small box. That will give us an indication whether a revenue impact is also generated by the bill proposal. And that's something that we look at most closely in our ability to track a bill. The main thing that I would look at is the state cost savings, which is the middle section of the fiscal note. And this will give you the overall impact not only by agency, but by fund. And that would be something that would be important to include on the tracking sheet. And then finally, you'll have more information further on down the sheet with respect to Legislative Budget Office contact information, and further in the note, other valuable information. But that gives you a clue on how we would use both fiscal notes and revenue estimates in the committee. Mr. Chair, that concludes the presentation on the fiscal overview.
Is there any
ready for questions?
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the Minnesota heading on here, Minnesota House of Representatives, House Fiscal Analysis Department. It's the first spreadsheet that you said they had the A, B, C, D, G columns on it.
Okay.
And what I'm questioning, I follow everything on here except one thing I'm not quite following, and it's the second page, lines 68 through 81, the local pensions aides. And I may have my answer to my question, but I'm going to ask it, and if I'm not, then I'm going to ask you to help me with it. We had an adjustment in certain communities receiving additional local government aid for offsets on pension increases that I think occurred in like 1997 or something like that. And we continue to pay those payments. Is that what this is, or am I missing what that would be, because there was an increase where we, as the state, increased contributions by local employers, but then we turned around with state revenues to backfill those. Is that what this is, or is that something different?
Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and Representative, if you turn to the catalog of budget activities.
I don't know that I have that document. I was looking for it before.
It looks like.
Yeah, I don't have that one.
Okay. In the catalog of budget activities on page 33, it gives a summary of the responsibility of pension aides between the property tax division and state government finance. And so there are different items that we track, and to reach back to the 1997 aid, that one in particular is reflected in state government finance, where you see, I don't have these lines numbered, but the St. Paul TRA 1997 aid, Minneapolis TRA 1997 aid. So it depends on which local government you're looking to for that change. Basically, the aids that this division oversees with respect to pensions has to do with volunteer firefighters and some local police and fire aides, where those local governments predated some of the state programs, and so there is aid to cover what those liabilities would be. So I would need more information to be able to give you more detail on for your response.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps. I also serve on the Pension Commission, and so does Representative Nelson. I'm just trying to tie these two things together for the work that we do on both of those particular areas, and it's linking up very nicely, making some sense. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Ms. Schill. So we're going to move on to CPA LGA school levy presentation by House Research, and I believe we have Mr. Swanson that is going to begin.
Mr. Chair and members, Jared Swanson from House Research. Ms. Schill and I are going to just provide a little bit of background on historical distributions of county program aid and local government aid. I'll include a little bit of background on school district property tax levies as well. One last thing I wanted to mention before we get started on these slides is that members should have in their packets an LGA run and a county program aid run. So the LGA run will show you how much local government aid each city in the state is going to receive in 2023. A projection of what each city is set to receive in 2024, and those are under current law. The county program aid run, the data for 2024 projection is not ready yet, but it does show the 2022 and 2023 aid amounts, and that might be helpful as we work through these slides. So beginning with county program aid, CPA was, in its current form, has existed since 2004. Prior to that time, counties received aid through a number of different aid programs. So there was an attached machinery aid, homestead and ag credit aid, criminal justice aid, a family preservation aid. All of these different aids had separate distributions and separate appropriations. So these separate aids were all eliminated in 2004, and a general purpose state aid to counties was created. You can see sort of the initial county program aid distributions on the graph on this slide. So beginning in 2005 through 2007, around 2008 through 2011, the county program aid distributions were reduced due to state budgetary conditions. But the total appropriation was ultimately dropped permanently in 2010. Since then, there have been a number of aid appropriation increases. So in 2014 and again in 2020 and 2021, all of those changes bring the county program aid total distribution to about $265 million annually. All 87 counties receive some amount of aid. There are two separate appropriations that make up the total county program aid distribution. So there's the need aid distribution, which distributes about $119 million a year. And this formula distributes aid based on each county's share of the population in the state age 65 or older, the number of Part 1 crimes or serious crimes within each county, and the number of households within each county receiving federal nutrition assistance. And then the second half of the aid formula is the tax-based equalization aid, and that distributes just under $146 million a year. And the factors within that formula are just the tax base within the county as well as the county's population. In 2017, there was a guarantee added to the tax-based equalization aid portion of the formula. So this ensured that counties that had a lot of ag land weren't losing as much tax-based equalization aid. Now, at this time, there were sort of soaring ag valuations, and some of these counties were losing most of that portion of the aid. Moving over to local government aid, or LGA, this is the general purpose aid program for cities. We talked a little bit about it in our overview a couple of weeks ago, but this state aid distributes just over $564 million annually. And this aid program actually dates back to the 1960s, the late 1960s, when a portion of the newly enacted state sales tax was dedicated to cities as a way to provide property tax relief. The revenue sharing program that existed then was converted to a true state aid in 1971 as a part of the Minnesota Miracle. Since then, LGA has gone through many iterations. There have been changes to the distribution formula, changes to the overall aid amount. The last major reform was in 2013, and those changes bring us largely to where we are today with LGA in terms of the formula. There have been some increases to the appropriation since then. So the current state of LGA, again, the appropriation is just over $564 million. That appropriation had been indexed to inflation in the 1990s. The inflator was removed in 2003 as a part of a formula reform effort engaged in that year. I mentioned on the last slide that the last formula update was in 2013. And at that time, there were concerns with the sort of the accuracy of the formula in determining each city's need. But there were also some concerns with the way the distributions of LGA had shifted. So at that time, with the new formula developed in 2013, there was sort of an effort made to get the distribution between greater Minnesota and metro cities to be about equal, so right around 50% to the metro area cities and 50% to the greater Minnesota cities. You can see on the current slide that shift has sort of happened again. Currently, about two-thirds of LGA goes to greater Minnesota cities and another one-third to metro cities. And one of the factors that's sort of contributing to this is that many cities have fallen off the formula. So we'll talk about the formula in the next couple of slides. But basically what's happened is that about 112 cities have sort of been determined by the formula to not be needy enough to receive LGA. And 82 of those cities are in the metro area. Again, the last work done on the formula was in 2013, but the legislature last session sort of engaged in some of this work again. And House File 4064 last year had an update to the LGA distribution formula. Obviously, that was not enacted last year, but sort of the work to develop the formula had occurred. So. You know, nonpartisan staff along with city groups went through the similar processes that had been undertaken in 2013 to develop a new formula. So the idea behind the current LGA formula is that each city has this measure determined in something known as unmet need. And each city's unmet need is it's a function of two different calculations. So the formula determines each city's need, and the factors that go into that determination vary by city size. We'll take a look at those on the next slide. But the formula also takes a look at each city's ability to pay. And ability to pay is equal to the city's property tax base times the statewide average city property tax rate.
All
This slide shows the factors that go into determining what each city's need is. You can see they do vary by population size, so cities are grouped into one of three categories based on population, and need is determined based on the factors within that grouping. I don't know that we need to go into great detail on these, but some of the factors that determine need include population, the age of housing stock within the within each city, household size, and the number of jobs within each city. Again, the full list is on that current slide. So what the LGA formula does is it takes this calculation of unmet need and uses it to determine a final aid amount for each city. So if a city's unmet need is less than the aid that it received in the previous year, its aid will decrease. So meaning, you know, the city is determined by the formula is less needy than it had been in the previous year, so that city is going to receive less LGA. The amount that it would be reduced to would either be the city's unmet need, but reductions in LGA from one year to the next are subject to maximum decreases, and that's sort of on the bottom of this slide. Conversely, if a city's unmet need is greater than the aid it received in the previous year, then that city's LGA will increase. However, there's not enough money within the appropriation to cover all of each city's unmet need as determined by the formula. So when a city's unmet need does increase, there's not enough money to sort of bring them fully up to that unmet need amount, which is why that the formula on the sort of second sub-bullet under formula aid shows that the increase is sort of a certain percentage of the gap between a city's unmet need and the aid that it received in the previous year. What the LGA formula does is it determines how much each city's increases would be and then reduces them all proportionately in order to match the total amount of money that's available for LGA. The final aid amounts are also adjusted by any non-formula aid. This used to be a more common feature within LGA where there were these sort of side distributions to individual cities. Most of those have been eliminated. There is still one city that receives non-formula aid, and that's the city of Manoman. And then again at the bottom of the slide, you can see the sort of maximum decreases that a city can receive in LGA from one year to the next, and that's the lesser of $10 per capita or 5% of the city's levy in the previous year. And Mr. Chair, Ms. Schill is now going to talk a little bit about LGA and as a share of local revenues.
If it's okay, I think I'll ask questions or offer questions. I believe Chair Gomez had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Lissagard. Going back to page, I don't know, there's no page numbers, it looks like. Factors determining county program aid. I'm just wondering about the under the need aid, why can you just talk to me about the share of population age 65 or older being the metric? I guess as I'm thinking about what counties' obligations are, I can also see it going the other way, like about like giving sort of counties where there are a lot of young people who maybe are in financial need being another kind of factor that you could consider instead of the number of elders. So if you could just explain that to me, please.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, I think part of it is sort of what you hinted at is that at least some county obligations is maybe to provide social services to seniors. That's not to say that there aren't also obligations for, other groups of individuals. I don't believe that the current county program aid formula sort of went through the same process of developing a need formula like the LGA formula has gone through in the past. I think these factors are at least in part carryovers from some of those older aid programs that got consolidated in 2004 in order to create this new state aid program. So I'd have to look back a little bit further in the history to sort of see where that came from. But I think the idea of need aid within the county formula is not really the same as need within the LGA formula. In as much as the need formula within LGA has been developed by regression models that really attempt to kind of narrow in on the factors that determine how needy a city is. I don't know that that happened with this formula, just because I believe it's mostly based in prior aid programs that predated county program aid. But I can look into that a little bit more and see where that factor came from.
Chair Gomez.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Lissagard. I guess I'm that kind of concerns me, I think, if we're using sort of an, I'll be interested to hear, kind of thoughts from the counties about this particular issue, especially like, I mean, I understand maybe if like the need calculation hasn't been updated in a long time since all of these other aids were consolidated into this, that we might need to take a look at that. I guess I would say from my time in serving, I didn't serve on the Human Services Committee, but I served on the Conference Committee. And, a lot of obligation a lot of the ways that we, kind of as a society tried to take care of vulnerable children does flow to the counties. I think we maybe want to talk a little bit more about that. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the tax chair's curiosity. In other committees, we've heard about the percent of disability and mobility issues, and it's pretty large for the senior citizens. And the county has responsibility for a lot of social services, and they're administering and et cetera. And my assumption, not having the data in front of me, is that that is part of the reason why that's included. But my curiosity is in a couple of different areas. Looking at the LGA medium and large cities with the old housing, what proportionality of dollars is this? Because I noticed the third largest city actually has 18 cities that receive more actual dollars. Some of them receiving over 2,400% more per capita. And so I'm trying to understand that huge delta. And one of the things I realize with Rochester is a lot of its growth has been since 1970. So proportionality of, the funds going in for old housing, just a ballpark.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I guess I have maybe a couple points on that. So, the way that need is determined for large cities, Rochester would be included in this is, two of those factors are, housing stock, built before 1970, so both between before 1940 and then between 1940 and 1970. I don't know the proportions of those as far as, how much each of those factors kind of contribute to overall need off the top of my head, but I can look that up and get that to you. One other thing I'll say about current distributions is that, when you see a lot of cities that are losing LGA, it's typically not because of the need side of the formula. So if you look at the sort of the unmet need formula, there's two parts. There's the need and the ability to pay. A lot of cities that are falling off the formula or that are currently losing LGA from one year to the next, it usually has more to do with the ability to pay, that their tax-based growth has been really strong, and that's what's sort of pushing them off the formula. But I can get those proportions to you.
Okay, my apologies. We're going to have to continue to go because we have four more people, but if you have one more question.
Well, what I'd like for offline data also include the actual formulas that we're talking to, and then some of the breakdowns. And then on the counties, I noticed that the ones I'm familiar with, Dodge, Olmsted, Steele, Wabasha, Winona, they're all negative on the county aid. So I'd like to better understand the factors in that. And if you had a statewide map with the counties, and it might be good for the cities, seeing the delta in change. So we see where areas are, you know, because the hint was maybe looking at the formula, we could see areas that are sink, you know, they're dropping in the aids, and areas that are increasing, so we can better understand the dynamics regionally. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. Again, going back, I'm looking at the county program aid thing, and I was kind of caught by surprise. One of the criteria for determining the aid is crime. And just wondering that as the number of crimes in a county increases, does their aid increase, or what is that relationship in county aid?
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, yeah, that's correct. So the idea with that portion of the formula is that, you know, counties that have more Part 1 crimes, and these are more serious crimes, would be needier than other counties. You know, perhaps they need more law enforcement or something like that. But the idea is that, yeah, more Part 1 crimes would result in a higher share of the overall aid distribution.
Representative Anderson.
Okay.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you. So one of my questions was about the crime also. That was interesting. My other question is, I'm trying to wrap my head around this, and I'm trying to understand why population decline, other than that it's a tax base, why that would increase the need. It seems like that would just exacerbate inequities between cities even further. And I guess from my perspective, representing a very densely populated city, you know, there might be reasons why there's population decline in other areas that aren't fully reflected in this need calculation. Can we dig into that like a little bit?
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins, so I guess maybe I'll mention a couple of things on this. So you can maybe imagine a couple of cities where you know, maybe the population is the same, but one is has a different population density. So I know this is not the exact factor that you mentioned, but I think I'll start here. So, you know, population density could, you know, that could affect need, in that if you have two cities of the, you know, same population size, but one is far less dense, they may have, you know, more streets or more infrastructure than a city that is perhaps more dense, in terms of, like, if you think of it as like infrastructure per capita, which is not really a measure, but, you know, just sort of a way to think about this. And I think that the peak population decline sort of ties into that a little bit. So if you had a city that had perhaps been more dense and, you know, had sort of, at least compared to its population, it probably had less infrastructure needs per capita, but then that population were to decline dramatically, it would still have all of those same infrastructure needs, but less population. And population is a factor within the formula, so it's just sort of trying to get at the differences in between, you know, cities of similar sizes that maybe have different needs.
Representative Hollins.
So just, I don't need an answer for this, but the people who are leaving one city are going to another place. And so while there might be more people or higher population density in one area, that means those roads are often being used more frequently than the roads in a lower population density area. So I understand what you're saying, like the per capita aspect, but I also think that maybe that's not taking into full account of the realities of how we use our structures and infrastructure.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Real quick, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, this is more a request of something I can make sense of here. So I'm also on this, crime's a part of this, but fire might be a little part of this, but EMS, my favorite word, isn't. So is it possible to get a spreadsheet that would tell me county, cities within that county, population of those cities, and total aid given to those cities, again, by county, so I can look at it in a county lens, and then which cities are within that realm, and population is important too. Is that possible to get that spreadsheet?
Mr. Swanson, can you make that happen?
Yeah, Mr. Chin, Representative Hewitt, I can certainly send something to the committee that, breaks out LGA and groups the cities into counties.
And the same with if we can get the county number with that, too. Thank you, sir. Yep. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair, these next two slides are meant to just provide a little bit of perspective. You asked, I believe, two meetings ago, how did, over a 20-year time period, how did LGA compare to the state general fund and its growth? So under Part A on this particular table, you'll see total expenditures of the state general fund from fiscal 2003, it's a snapshot, and then fiscal 2023, and you'll see that the state general fund grew from about $14 billion to about $27 billion and just under 100% growth, whereas the appropriation for local government aid remained pretty much steady if you only take those two snapshots. Mr. Swanson's slide showed you the variation over that time period. And so as a component of the general fund expenditures, LGA has gone from about 4.1% reduced to 2.1%, which was the answer to your question. Now, one thing to consider also during that same time span, okay, what was the behavior of other non-school local tax revenues? And that's what Part B of this slide shows. So if you take a look at the growth in property taxes over that period, they grew just under 150%. Sales taxes grew 644%. Other taxes, 148%. And so you can see how those shifts of revenues have grown and changed and where the emphasis lies. On this next slide, okay, this does not measure percent of change, but it's just volume. And this part is very important in my mind, is the top three bars show the property tax, sales tax, and other taxes. And the growth in the property tax is undisputed. You can see that it is approximately more than doubled. The other bars in this chart show non-tax revenue change. And apart from that select enterprise revenue category, think water, sewer, and some other kinds of uses where you can have a direct charge for a service provided, you'll see charges for services have increased tremendously as well. So you have this change in other tax revenues as well as the tax revenues at the local level, just to give you some perspective of where the monies are coming from.
Mr. Chair and members, lastly, we're just going to end with a couple of introductory slides to the school property tax levies. This is just sort of to give a little context to some of the testimony that I think you'll hear from testifiers later in the hearing. So about 20% of Minnesota school funding comes from local property taxes. Another 7% comes from other local sources, and a much higher share comes from state aid to school districts. Property tax revenue varies substantially from one school district to the next, which is partially the reason for the equalization that I think you're going to hear about from one of the testifiers today. So while property taxes are really a small portion of overall school district revenues, the amount of property tax that actually goes to school districts when you look at the total statewide amount of property taxes paid is about 29%. So of the total amount of property taxes paid in the state each year, 29% goes to school districts. These revenues are limited just to public school districts that have levy authority, so I just wanted to mention that charter schools do not receive local property tax revenues. In terms of school-related property tax relief, most of it comes from direct aid, direct state aid to school districts and from equalization. But there are also state-paid property tax credits that, as Ms. Schill mentioned earlier, directly reduce the final tax bill that individual taxpayers pay. The largest of these is the school building bond agricultural credit. This is the largest overall property tax credit, which distributed about $70 million last year. The sort of next highest property tax credit within the overall property tax system is the ag market value credit, which is about $36 million a year. And lastly, there are different types of property tax levies. So when you, when we talk about property tax revenues that go to schools, really on the school district side of things, they actually break these out into different types. You may remember from the overview presentation a couple of weeks ago that there are two property tax bases within the state, so that includes referendum market value, or RMV on the slide. And this tax base excludes ag land, cabins, and student housing. And then there's also the net tax capacity tax base, or NTC on the slide, which includes all property types and is a classified tax base. So this slide shows each of the different property tax, school property tax levies, and the tax base that each of these levy types use, and whether or not the levy is voter approved. And Mr. Chair, that concludes the overview of school-related property taxes and county program aid and local government aid.
Well, thank you both very much. We're going to have a pretty tight schedule remaining, but I'll open it up for any questions that the members may have. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To staff, so most of the members of the majority party are in the metro area, and so one thing we haven't covered is the issue of the fiscal disparities pool. Can you just briefly touch base on that and the impact it has not only within the seven county metro, but also its interactions with jurisdictions outside the metro? Thank you.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, perhaps a deep dive into fiscal disparities would be a whole hearing, but maybe just for members who aren't familiar with the program. So within the metro area, there was a fiscal disparities program created, again, in 1971, along with the Minnesota Miracle, that shares the growth in commercial industrial tax base among all jurisdictions within the metro area. So there's a base year within the statute of 1971. And any growth in commercial industrial tax base within a given jurisdiction, 40% of that growth actually goes to an area-wide pool. That tax base is distributed from that pool and shared with all of the jurisdictions within the metro area. Those jurisdictions that receive a sort of a tax base distribution from the pool get to tax that tax base. And the effect is that for some jurisdictions within the metro area, sort of the net property tax paid by certain property types within that jurisdiction is reduced because of this program. And then within other jurisdictions within the metro area, sort of the opposite is true, that some property types pay a little bit higher property tax, overall property tax rate because of the program. Additionally, there is an Iron Range fiscal disparities program that was enacted in the 90s that operates in the same way. It's much smaller since it hasn't been around for as long, but this sort of same idea of a base year being set in statute and then any, capturing any growth in commercial industrial tax base, sending it to a pool, sharing it from that pool with other jurisdictions in the Iron Range. It basically functions the same way.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the testifiers. So there may be a proposal coming forward, a scheme coming forward, maybe I'll say, that would capture some of the growth of the fiscal disparities pool and use that for other purposes. Can you just explain how that would actually interact with, if that were allowed to happen, how that would actually affect jurisdictions outside the seven county metro in terms of determining, we had an earlier conversation about need and explaining that. I guess I'm trying to ask a leading question here, and that is that if you use the growth in the fiscal disparities pool to spend money on things actually does have an interaction statewide. Can you explain why that would be? Or if you can't explain it, then I've kind of achieved my purpose anyways.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, I guess I'd maybe like to see the proposal first before speculating too much, but maybe I'll just confirm that it is possible, depending on how it's designed, that things that aren't necessarily related to a certain geographical area within the state could have an impact on state aids and other things like that. So that certainly is possible, yes.
And Mr. Chairman, maybe I just should have made a statement rather than trying to lead the witness or something like that. It's just that when the growth in the fiscal disparities pool is taken and used for other purposes, that actually makes the some jurisdictions in the seven-county metro more needy, which then qualifies for a greater portion of state aid, which then transfers part of the state aid from our other jurisdictions to those new needy cities. So that's more of a statement than a question. So thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you. Ms. Shaw.
Mr. Chair and members, if you turn to the catalog on page 30, there's a thumbnail description on fiscal disparities and spending over an eight-year time period, if that's helpful.
Thank you both so much. So next, we're going to have Matt Hilgart, Association of Minnesota Counties. And if we can go through, let everyone present, and then we will ask the member questions at the end.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. The AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I'm joined today by two county commissioners, Commissioner Trista Matas-Castillo from Ramsey County, and then Commissioner Patrick Boyle, who will be joining us from St. Louis County. And I think our plan today was try to divvy up our 12 or 14 minutes that we have to try to give you a broad brush strokes of what's going on and the property tax picture, the levy pressure picture, and then also talk about specific examples in communities. My goal this morning and my part of the presentation is just to frame up a broad picture of the factors that are contributing to local government budget pressures and property tax impacts. And those three broad factors that I'll be talking about are decline or stagnation in revenue sources, an increase in the costs of government, and the erosion of tax base. I'll then turn it over to the county leaders to talk specifically about their stories. The first one is the decline or stagnation of revenue resources. And on that one of the biggest pictures that you've probably heard from all the local government groups is the decline or stagnation of state aids, those being for counties, most importantly, the county program aid program, PILT, SCORE, also federal aids that we receive in several categories and buckets around our Child Protection Services and Social Services Administrations, as well as some local revenue sources like wind production for folks, Representative Anderson's district and some others in the Southwest. Counties are realizing significant reductions in their wind production tax. In addition, I think the House research pointed this out with certain sales tax income generating sources for the state. Well, the state has experienced a tremendous growth in some of their revenue sources, most notably sales tax and income tax, some corporate tax in the last 5 years. That is not the same for county governments or local governments. We are very much dependent on some of these state aid categories to supplement our budget pressures. And as such, when those aid pressures aren't growing but needs are, it creates tremendous pressure among our citizens and our residents. Some of our aid sources have been taken away, or some of our revenue sources have been taken away. Mortgage registry and deed taxes is a great example of this. We're responsible for all the work of that. We do that, we administer that, we take a 1% or 2% finder's fee, and we send around $200 million back to the state each year for the state general revenue fund. So in addition to not getting certain state aids, we're also seeing some of the revenue resources, the limited revenue resources we have, taken back. The second thing that I want to be very transparent about is the increase in the costs of government. And so if you look at a two-decade plus chart, you will see that government has grown in terms of its costs and its expenditures. We certainly have reasons for that, that we would say that our membership have been telling us. I would put these categories of reasons for that growth and new mandates, increase in the need of services, and growth in need of residents. A lot of the mandates that counties are responsible for are in those social safety net services. So you'll hear a lot of counties talking about family services, child well-being services, our probationary services. There was a question on why Part 1 crimes. Well, in the state of Minnesota, counties administer more than 80% of corrections and probationary services in the state. The growth in needs, I want to talk, one county that I talked to 2 months ago, Wadena County, very small county, said that 50 years ago they had 10 social workers and today they have 53. That's not because they're going out to try to increase that staffing. That's because their needs in their community are increasing and we have certain quotas that we have to hit on caseworkers per amount of cases. And so in their community, their social services levy is extremely high and disproportionate to other areas of the state. So that's an illustration of how some of those needs in terms of mandates and services will reflect in their actual levies. And the last one that I want to talk about is the erosion of tax base. And this is something we started talking about our last hearing, and I appreciate the time of that. I think I used the analogy of Swiss cheese, but over the last several decades, we have cut out many exemptions, we have shifted tax rates, or we have created exclusions in our tax base that further lessen the amount of people that are paying them. I know I talked about the disabled veterans homestead market value exclusion as being one of those chief exclusions. And I was just looking today, the most recent stats I have are from 2020, but there's $3.3 billion of total property value that are excluded from local tax bases because of this. So as bills come before this committee, that is one of the elements that are potentially contributing to those budget and levy pressures. I also think that in that mandate category I was talking about, there are certain things, a long list of small things that add up. One of those things that I just recently saw was indigent burial costs. So the state of Minnesota has said we folks always deserve a respectful burial provisions. And if they are not financially able to make those, counties, you will pay for them and do them. And we do that. And I think that is a good service and that we should, but there is no reimbursement for that. So in Hennepin County, it's over $1 million. In St. Louis County, Mr. Chair, the last stat I saw, it was over $450,000 a year. Likewise, we see several bills in terms of providing rental support or rental counsel or things like that. And many times these bills are drafted so that counties will be responsible for paying for those counsel costs or things like that. So you can see how small things that might be a couple hundred thousand here or there tend to also add up to where these mandates can be a certain percentage of a levy. When adding these three factors, to the historic market value increases we've seen in residential properties, you can see how this is not sustainable. I know in the other chamber, which I will not name, there was a discussion about the tax base being insufficient and unsustainable. Already they're having conversations realizing the same thing that we all are, which is that we're asking a limited amount of people to do a lot in terms of supporting the operations of local government. If I can leave you with any takeaways from this presentation, aside from my own perspective, our own association perspective of what's contributing to some of these costs, it'd be two things. Local governments are working. We are providing for the needs of our service, of our residents, and we are doing the best that we can with our limited resources and volatility. My favorite chart on the handout that I provided of just two basic charts isn't the one that necessarily shows the how far off we are in CPA as a basis of inflation for the last two decades, but it's the first one. And it shows the heart rate monitor, basically, of what we get in state and federal aid resources. And you can see increases and dramatic decreases, but the flat purple line, the flat-ish purple line, is our average annual levy increase. Counties are typically fighting with townships for the lowest annual levy increase. Usually townships win. But I think that that is a good barometer of, even in this era of instability, market pressures, et cetera, the mandates, et cetera, local governments are trying to do their best to remain stable and provide citizens for our services for their residents. And the second thing that I would say is an important takeaway is that there are solutions, and we don't have to start from scratch. A lot of what was in the tax bill in terms of a property tax relief package last year was a great start. We would ask that we take a look at some of those mechanisms, targeted property tax refund, homestead exclusion, senior property tax deferral as a starting place, and maybe even beefing up some of those options. We would also ask that for a commitment of strengthening our tax base. If we want to provide an additional disabled veterans market value exclusion, fantastic. Let's make it a credit and pay for it. If we want to do a affordable homestead exclusion for developers with 20% of their properties in AMI, and we're going to exclude 50% of their tax base, that was a proposal last year which should have huge implications for our tax base, make it a credit. Don't make it an exclusion. So that's the other layer that we'd be asking for. And last but not least, our pitch, our elevator pitch for CPA and LGA are important components of this equation. And Mr. Chair, we're thankful for the conversations you've already had on these important elements, but we certainly think, and you can look at that chart below, that we have a very telling and fair request in terms of reassessing that state and local partnership and investing in your locals who you ask so much of. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ramsey County Board Chair Trista Matas Castillo.
Commissioner,
hello.
Please state your name for the record and then continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Trista Matas Castillo. I'm the chair of the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, and I'm here representing not only Ramsey County but all of our 87 counties. I'd like to share a story of the work that Ramsey County does, and I will tell you by and large that every county does the same work. It's just a matter of scale. Add a few more zeros in any number, but it all applies. You know, we have spent, and it's easiest because we're all so familiar with what happened when the pandemic hit and all the things that have occurred and why we're reacting in the way that we are. As Matt said, revenues at the state went up. They either fell flat at counties or actually were reduced at counties. We saw a dramatic increase in need in our community during COVID, and a response had a huge cost. One of the things DHS did, which was really fantastic, was make it easier for people to apply for assistance. And we saw a 120% increase in people applying. Unfortunately, once you came in the door, nothing of the system changed to make it easier to process, nor were there any additional staff allowed or allocated for us to actually process that huge increase. So we're now seeing 6 to 12 week delays in a response to emergency assistance, and which is woefully inadequate. We recognize that, but there's a huge cost and a burden, and this is across every county in the state. As human services providers in the state, we want to meet the emergent needs of our community, and we're unable to do it because we simply can't afford it. We can't afford to pay staff. We can't afford to deliver the services. In addition, you know, right outside these doors, we saw more than 480 people sleeping outside just 2 years ago. And we worked really hard in Ramsey County to accommodate and to bring people inside. But that's an incredible cost. We were able to use some of the federal dollars that came down to meet those needs, but it didn't cover the cost of additional public service, fire, police, or our staff to actually be able to do that work. And we know that this is a benefit for everyone in the state to make sure people are safely housed in dignified spaces, that they're fed and taken care of, but the cost burden is huge. I will just say that any addition to county program aid is a direct buy down to our levies. And I will say that it is in every county's budget as a line item. You will see a proposed levy minus CPA with the final levy that's proposed to taxpayers. It's written and documented. It's on the public record. There's no reason why we can't do a direct buy down through an increase of county program aid. This is critically important for the work that we do. It is what brings life to every one of your communities where you all live and the districts you represent for services to your community.
Thank you so much. We have Commissioner Boyle. If you guys could stay around, that would be wonderful for questions. Commissioner, if you could state your name and then proceed.
Yes, Patrick Boyle, St. Louis County Commissioner and Chair this year. And I just want to touch base on St. Louis County. It's the only county where you can go fishing for lake trout on the mouth of the Knife River at sunup, drive 3 hours while still in St. Louis County, and fish for walleye at Crane Lake at sundown. I did it myself, so I know. This is my 10th year on the board, so many times the student becomes the historian. And bear with me, I'm going to be doing the meat and potatoes of my version of what has happened in the history of the state of Minnesota in county relationships. Of reduced rates of state aid to counties that evolved in higher property taxes at the county side. During the 1970s, landmark legislation was passed in Minnesota. It was founded on the principle that local governments are in the best position to administer many of the new health and human service programs in our state. A state-county partnership was created, resulting in three new big block grant programs. As you well know, the Community Health Service Block Grant, the Community Corrections Grant, and Act, and the Community Social Services Act. Nearly all other states' employees deliver such services would be state employees, but not Minnesota. Instead, these are county employees, and we're darn proud of it. But at the same time, this saves the state general fund quite a bit. And that leads me on to the history. For the first few decades of these block grant programs were tremendously successful, but at the cost of delivering these services began to climb, suddenly the partnership with the state became more one way. Gradually, what was supposed to be a 50-50 share instead became a 4-to-1 to 5-to-1 county cost to share. To this day, such costs shifted to the county taxpayers. Simultaneously, Minnesota's expansive income maintenance, IAM programs, were also costing counties tens of millions, in addition to local property taxes. Until the early 1990s, counties' taxes paid anywhere from 5% of cost share to medical assistant costs to 25% of the general assistance. As you well know, property taxes are the most regressive way to raise revenue. They punish counties with low tax base, and they punish poor people who own property, which is significant in my county. Fortunately, by the late 1990s, legislation recognized this disparity and unfairness. They voted to have the progressive state income tax and sales tax take over 100% of all income maintenance costs. The aggressive property tax would no longer have to pay for IAM, or at least that's what we were told. The only catch to the state's takeover, this is a little more complicated, of the IAM costs, was counties would no longer receive the base year equivalent state property tax dollars that were already receiving through what was known as the HACA, Homestead Agricultural Credit Aid. Nevertheless, counties jumped at the chance to remove IAM from direct costs or budgets. The remaining county HACA dollars were combined with a few other smaller state aid programs, and it became today, as we well know, the CPA, the county program aid. Unfortunately, the same thing happened in time. The example of a health and human services block programs, within a few years, the state began shifting new income maintenance costs onto counties. The net result was meant higher and higher county property taxes. The historic state takeover of county IM was effectively undone. Mr. Chair, in conclusion, Minnesota budget surplus presents a unique opportunity for Minnesota to catch up and begin to fully program county program aid. CPA increase combined with your separate, and I think it's coming out today, Mr. Chair, of PILT legislation will go a long way in helping counties with property taxes, not only in St. Louis County, but the Arrowhead region. So I thank you.
Thank you so much. If you could stay around for questions, that'd be wonderful. Next, we have Nathan Jessen, League of Minnesota Cities. I don't know if you're comfortable or you know this room very well, Mr. Jessen, but you could state your name for the record and continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Jessen. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. So just first, just one quick words about the League of Minnesota Cities. You know, our goal is to promote excellence in local government through effective advocacy, expert analysis, and trusted guidance for all Minnesota cities. Minnesota has 854 cities. The league represents 837 of them. And I just bring that up in particular because 854 cities means a lot of unique budgets with their own sets of challenges. And, you know, I'm going to try to identify some patterns and trends here today, but there's really, when you're talking about 854, that's a wide array of cities and budget challenges. And I know you've talked about the property tax timeline some in your previous hearings, but I'm just going to go through it really quickly again today. Just to remind you, it really plays out over 2 years, and there's three stages. You've got valuations, which happen from March to April, and you've got the appeals there. You've got the levy setting itself and incorporating feedback from taxpayers during truth and taxation. Final levies being set in December. And then you've got the payments the following year. So property taxes do often kind of face a lag sometimes when we're talking about valuations. And, Mr. Chair, you asked me to see if we could, you know, look at some trends and valuations in particular across the state. This is statewide data taken from the Department of Revenue for 2021 valuations, okay? So, as you can see, commercial value, estimated market value declined by 1%. That's after pretty regular increases, steadier increases in the 5 years leading up to it. That obviously creates a shift when you've got certain property types increasing in value and others decreasing. The most other notable change here is on the residential non-homestead. That value increased by 13.7% compared to 6.8% from 2016 to 2020, a pretty significant jump. I do think that a lot of that was caused by a 2020 law change having to do with short-term rental property being reclassified from commercial property to residential non-homestead, essentially lowering it from the 2% to 1.25% rate. And then we've got the 22 statewide average valuation trends. This is preliminary data. I'd like to thank the Department of Revenue for sharing it with the cities. And here's where you really see the big jumps that you've probably been hearing about from your constituents. You've got commercial property increasing now at 2.7%, but that's a much smaller increase than most other property types. Residential homestead property jumped 17.8%. That's a really sizable increase. Cabin property, which was up 6.5% in 2021, jumps 24%. That's, again, a very high increase. And I think, you know, some of these trends we're seeing are probably related to the pandemic. And then residential non-homestead increased by 18.1%. Not still increasing from the year before, but not as dramatic a jump when you're talking about a percentile basis. Property tax levy changes. So in November, the Department of Revenue released statewide preliminary levy data that showed city levies increasing by 9.1%. The previous five-year average was 5.6. The revenue will release final levy data in February. It's important to remember that the final level data of the final levies can decrease. They cannot increase. We normally, last year, for example, there was a $70 million reduction from preliminary levies to final levies for cities. The average decrease, that was about 14%. Sometimes we see higher, sometimes we see lower, but, and I just want to like call out a few cities that, you know, the key when looking at the levy increase is that the thing to remember is that tax capacity increased also, right? We saw those values increase significantly, whether they be residential homestead. So in a lot of cases, levies increased while rates remained the same. The other 2% of cities cut their levies, 14% kept their levies flat. 20% had between a 0 and 5% increase, and 33% were, or 64% were higher than 5%. So what are the causes for higher levies, right? Like, why are levies going up right now more than they did a year or two ago? I think that, you know, the thing I always want to stress is that there's not only one thing that causes levies to increase or decrease, but one thing that I do have on this list that affects every other bullet point and has really been affecting cities' budgets is inflation. Inflation rose much faster in 2022 than expected, and the 2022 budgets weren't expecting the increase, so the 2023 budgets kind of reflect 2 years of inflation right now. And inflation affects the cost of capital projects, whether you're talking about roads or building a new fire station. It affects rising wages, and it, like you saw on the valuation side, it addresses growth in cities' net tax capacity. And when inflation is going up and state aids, as Mr. Hilgart mentioned, like local government aid, are stagnant and set by a dollar amount, the buying power of that local government aid essentially goes down, right? Levers to consider, you know, the state doesn't set property taxes other than the state general tax, right, on commercial industrial property. So I'm just going to start with local government aid. Department of Revenue Tax Research assumes that a portion of local government aid goes toward levy reduction. So LGA is one method to try to hold down levies overall on the front end. I think, as Ms. Schill mentioned, in 2002, LGA represented about 4.1% of the state budget. Today it's closer to 2%. Also in 2002, LGA plus city levies equaled about, LGA represented about one-third of local government aid plus levies, right? And today that's about one-sixth. So really any way you slice it, state investment on LGA has, though we're still, we did reach the 2002 levels on a static basis, the buying power isn't nearly what it was 20 years ago. Other things to consider, the homestead market value exclusion. I know that last year this body passed an increase in the homestead market value exclusion. That's not going to reduce levies, but it can address residential property taxes. That was set in 2011 for the first 76,000 having a higher percentage break. Once you get to $413,000 in value, that benefit's not there anymore for homeowners. Those are the same numbers as they were in 2011 when that became law. And just $413,000 isn't as great a benefit as it was in 2011. Another thing is just, and this is something Mr. Hilgart mentioned, limiting property tax shifts onto a residential property. You know, I think there will be a number of bills introduced this year that provide property tax benefits through shifts. That's fairly common. But when you examine those proposals, it's important to not just examine them looking only at that proposal. They should also be taken together, thinking about, okay, this one plus the other ones, plus existing shifts, they're already there. What kind of shift are those causing onto residential property? And then there's also property tax refunds. These aren't going to increasing property tax refunds isn't going to lower levies. It's not going to lower residential property taxes that taxpayers pay up front. They do reimburse taxpayers on the back end. And I've got the three largest property tax refund programs here. The homestead credit refund and the renter's credit are both income capped, and the targeted property tax refund is not. There's certain thresholds and income caps and co-pays that go with the homestead credit refund and renter's credit. You know, the Lee Minnesota City supports looking at those and seeing if it makes sense to adjust them higher. There are some challenges with that program in that it's a separate filing, so sometimes it's difficult to get taxpayers aware of those programs. That's a challenge that we faced, and the League has in the past supported methods of, whether it be through notification or other means, of trying to raise awareness of those programs. So that's another tool that this committee has when it's looking at different methods and approaches to keep property taxes where they'd like to see them. So that's just my quick presentation, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to answer questions or go on to the next testifier, whichever you prefer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Justin. We're going to move on to Brad Lundell with the schools. Sorry. Please, you know, we're running short on time, so if we could.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education, and just would say that there's a lot of rabbit holes here, and Mr. McClellan said stay in one. So, again, I think the thing is with the school levies, schools are very much dictated as to what they can levy without voter approval. But the big problem that we've had is that the equalization refactors have are usually expressed as a constant. And as property wealth grows, the aid goes down and the levy goes up. And that usually goes across anywhere where there's a constant for the equalizing factor. I think that is the big problem we've had. You'll look at the handouts that I've given you, shows the erosion of the referendum equalizing factor. Back in the mid-90s when this was established, it was about $150 million, and this is in nominal dollars now, not inflation-adjusted dollars. And now we're down in the referendum equalization of less than $20 million, and if you add the local option revenue, it still stays below $100 million. So if you look at the fact that the state average property wealth per pupil on the referendum market value has gone up more than 400%, the equalizing factor has only gone up 20%. We can talk about debt service as well. That's another area where we've simply lagged behind where the progress that was made during the 1990s when those programs were established. We've got bills this year to try to upgrade those equalizing factors and bring down thresholds for eligibility on the debt service equalization. So I won't belabor the fact, belabor things any longer, but that's kind of the synopsis that we have. You can look at the three documents that I put out. And again, we look forward to, it's always great to come over to the tax committee. I put on my best suit and it's good to be here. And, you know, I need to impress you guys. Over in education, they're kind of tired of me. So thank you very much. And again, any questions that you have moving forward, I hope to meet with many of you this session to talk about the equalization of the school levies. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Chair Gomez, you had a question earlier. You're good?
Yeah, I don't remember what I was asking.
Okay. Representative Guam?
Thank you. And a lot of, Mr. Chair, and a lot of this can come offline. I noticed in the presentation there was a 1% decline in commercial estimated market value. And I'd like to find out how much of a percentage or a component of that is because of the, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, there's a decreased occupancy. There's been a lot of closures. You know, they had fires and crime. And I'm assuming that being a large portion of the state, you know, how much that might be. You know, again, and that could be off to the side. Also, there's in the factors for county program aid, they've got a number of households receiving federal nutrition assistance. I haven't been on the school board, and the Byron school board I was on, our tax capacity was 17% below the state average. We were a property poor district, it still is. However, in the formula, we're either on the bottom or the bottom three per pupil funding because a lot of the families didn't sign up for free and reduced lunches, which goes into the factor for county program aid of federal nutrition assistance in those programs. And that it'd be nice to understand the impact that might come from total free and reduced lunches in the schools, the byproduct effect with no one registering would be an impact on the county aid. And then I didn't see in the factors there being a thing saying square miles, because a county is giving services across their space. Mm-hmm. And St. Louis County and other counties have a lot of square miles per person. And I'm surprised that isn't part of a factor of calculation. So if we can have a better, you know, the formulas and a breakdown. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. We'll work on it. Any other questions? Representative Hollins?
Yes, I had Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for the counties, which is if we were to do an increase in CPA, how much would we need to keep the levies flat?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins. That's a great question. So I can answer specifically for Ramsey County. A $3 million increase is 1% on the levy. We have kept our levies flat at about 2.5% on average for the last 10 years. We're currently looking at a double-digit increase to keep the lights on and programs operating as they are today. So we would need an additional $30 million to Ramsey County specifically, which is about $350 million statewide to help counties across the state keep their levies flat. Just as an example, the governor put $30 million additional CPA in his budget, which would give us a buy-down, direct buy-down of 0.7% in Ramsey County specifically.
Representative Hollins?
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll make this quick. If the we've got a unique situation. We have a kind of a greater Minnesota commissioner here, if he would join us, and we have a metro commissioner. And I'm going to ask them both the same question, and then they can respond accordingly. The question is, with the work from home and different things, how much of your facilities that you currently have that you have to pay debt service on and operating and maintenance are now repopulated with workers who would have been working from home? And how are you dealing with that? Because it seems to me if you have the space, you should have the folks back there using it. And when you're paying for the operations and maintenance and debt service on those. So just kind of looking for some insight on that, if they could provide that for us this morning.
Absolutely. I'm willing Commissioner? To start. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. So about no matter COVID or post-COVID, pre-COVID, 50% of our employees have to be on site at all times because they're corrections workers, law enforcement, those kinds of things. They never went hybrid. Roads have to be maintained, all of those things. 13% of our employees are mobile workers, so think public health, visiting nurses, those kinds of things. Again, they were never hybrid. They were always mobile. The rest of our workers come into the office 3 days a week minimum in our hybrid option of work. And accordingly, we have actually been able to shrink our footprint significantly. We've consolidated all of our spaces. We're actually putting then new vacant buildings on the market to sell so that we can liquidate those assets. But we've been able to shrink our footprint, so we're not stuck having empty buildings that we're continuing to pay for.
Commissioner Boyle?
I would just add, similar results of what we're doing in St. Louis County, and we are so mobile. You know, you might be a social worker and have a case that's an hour and a half away from you. So I think with the hybrid and also a good point of post-pandemic is that the workforce to hire the millennials coming out right now of colleges and techs are wanting to have a hybrid, so we have to offer that to get the best of the workforce that we need. So we definitely changed post-pandemic, I think, in a good way. The county owns 98% of their buildings in St. Louis County. So, it's one of those hybrid plans that we use for about 25% of our workforce. Thank you.
Representative Driscoll?
I just want to thank the testifiers for that because, as we've discussed previously in this committee, that when the property values are going to be going down on commercial, and if they're divesting themselves of other properties that they have, that's going to have an impact on the market value. So I think we need to keep an eye on two or three intersections down the road and the cross traffic that we're going to be experiencing on that as well with the shift in and right sizing, if you will, of commercial industrial property available within the state of Minnesota, not just the metro area.
Wonderful point. Well, I want to thank everyone and kind of give you the lay of the land. We're going to start moving to bills next week. And what we have done since the beginning of committee is kind of lay it out. Like I said, peel back the onion. And we can see that there are shifts happening that, reduces it for one and increases it for others. We know that schools aren't fully funded and causes levy increases. We see that local government aid and county aid is well short, 2.1 versus what it used to be, 4% or 4.1 of the budget. And we start to have conversations, what are cities doing? Well, that's why we see so many local option sales tax. We see different creative TIF situations because we are not providing the very services or the very funding to help cities and counties and schools maintain what we're trying to do. And so I think it's important. I have a much better understanding. I hope that you do. But there are different levers that we're going to be able to work with to try to help address it. I think the governor's laying out his commitment and investment in education is going to help with the schools. I'm committed to push very, very hard for local government aid and county municipal aid because I see that direct impact what you guys do. And with the commercial and industrial valuations going down and everything being shifted over to the residential, we have a problem. People are being taxed out of their homes. And that's our job to find ways to be able to help. So that's what I'm committed to doing, and the bills are going to start rolling. And so we'll probably see a lot more people participating, and I'm sure I'll be seeing more of you. So thank you so much. We are adjourned.